listening to the 18th Century Podcast. Welcome to A Student's Progress. Today we have with us our guest for the day is Andrew McKendry. Andrew, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. So I'm Andrew McKendry, associate professor at Nord University in Norway. I work primarily on 17th century religion. I used to work more in the 18th century on Defoe, and I've kind of moved backwards as one does. And I work in particular on how disability figured in 17th century debates about salvation and baptism and confirmation. And
that I've seen or heard some of your papers at various conferences.
Yes, and I have a chapter on the topic coming out in a new book edited by David Alvarez and Allison Conway called Imagining Religious Toleration.
Nice people. And as always, of course, Cal is here as well.
Hello, I'm back. Pleased to be here once again. I guess I did have an immediate question for Andrew just about disability in the 17th century in general. Is that the term that tends to get jockeyed around in the literature of the time, or is there a different term that gets used, multiple terms perhaps?
Well, that is a complicated historian rapid question. It is a term that figures significantly in debates at the time, but of course it means different things, right? So there's been debates about this recently about using the term, for instance, in relation to Shakespeare studies. Mm-hmm. The term is used in 17th century writing, but of course it has a much wider range of meanings at the time. Yeah. So one could be disabled to pay a debt, or you could be disabled by the law. You could have civil disabilities, which dissenters have. So some of my work is actually on how the term changed throughout the period. So how the meanings of it were reined in and regulated, really as part of regulating modes of salvation and controlling exceptions to salvation. So, but there's actually a debate about what kind of language we use when we talk about 17th century disability, right. Whether we use the... to use the term disability is to, in a way, add a lot of complications. You know, there's a value to engaging with those complications, even though you might then be looking at issues of civil disability at the same time as you're looking at what they would call at the time lameness or something like that.
Right? So absolutely beyond the kind of bodily.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The main ones are primarily economic and political would be the other one. So lots of stuff about the disabilities of Catholics. But for some writers like Richard Baxter, let's say, who both have impairments and also civil disabilities, those two are not always completely separate, right? So for instance, he was often prevented from worship, from holding services simultaneously by his painful ailments and by the law by which he was disabled by the Clarendon Code. Yeah. So those are kind of aligned in that case. So yeah.
What's the Clarendon Code?
It is, the set of laws from the early 1660s, primarily the Act of Uniformity, but also the Test Acts. Effectively, what they were meant to do was enforce uniformity to make it so that dissenters, those who were not part of the Anglican Church, you know, could not hold official office unless they subscribed.
Yeah. Yeah, the Test Acts are interesting. I read about those not too long ago. Yeah. Myself, and you had to swear allegiance to a particular faith.
Yeah.
In order to serve high office. Yeah. In
Anglicanism, was it?
The entire kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales.
Yeah. So you had to serve an office. You had to essentially swear an oath that aligned you, that subscribed you to the Church of England. And you had to attend Church of England services. Later on, there are kind of ways around that. There's practices of occasional conformity that some support. Some Defoe criticizes them as kind of selling out. But yes, you had to essentially willingly participate. First of all, if you were a minister, you had to hold services in Anglican form. And then personally, if you wanted to serve an office, you had to make an oath and attend Anglican worship, which, you know, to us might not sound terribly scruple-causing. But, of course, at the time, many refused to do that because, according to their consciences, for various reasons, it was wrong, you know. So, yeah, a good chunk of the population was excluded. I think dissenters made up about 5% of the population, anywhere from 5 to 10. It's obviously hard to know exactly, but, yeah. But, of course, economically, the story goes, they had disproportionate financial power, right? It's a matter of debate, but there you go.
Any sort of literary figure? You mentioned Defoe. Any other kind of literary figures we might recognize from the period that were
Let's see, other big dissenting writers. Let's see, I guess Defoe is probably the big one. Mm. Later in the century, of course, with the development of rational dissent, there's lots of figures who are associated with, like Joseph Priestley and Richard Price. Mm. Other big dissenting authors at the time. Well, I guess Pope is Catholic. So we were thinking of Protestant dissenters, but Pope, of course.
Yeah, just that's correct. A whole different religion. Yeah.
But and so he doesn't necessarily have the same position as someone like Defoe, of course.
No.
But both excluded from, you know, and they reacted differently, but both excluded from the kind of official establishment. So
living in grottos.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, for Pope, it's a little different than Defoe. But, you know, perhaps they reacted similar ways in some ways. Yeah.
Did you say Fielding also experienced some kind of religious change?
Fielding, to early on in his life, he's this really sort of reckless, I wouldn't go so far as to say he was, at least I don't know, he was kind of actively against any religious denomination whatsoever. But then later on in his life, when he starts to become less of this young, reckless, libertine figure, he has this kind of conversion to Catholicism. Once he contracts a lot of diseases and finds himself staring down at the pearly gates. Kind of just before we had started recording, too, we were having a discussion about, I guess, the separation between church and state a bit later, but around this time, and there was almost a political motivation for certain figures at the time to make a conversion to a certain faith. Did you want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. Oh, I see. When we were talking about Dryden.
Dryden in particular.
Sure, yeah. I wouldn't say that was why Dryden converted. But sure, yeah.
Agree to disagree.
And also, I mean, I think it's hard. I think it's when I talk to students about Dryden, and I mention this in passing, or when we talk about others who, you know, have to make certain shifts, like, let's say, Defoe or something. It's hard to explain to students. It's a difficult time, the 1660s, 70s, and 80s, because of the rapid and unsettling changes in regime, right? So let's say you're living, or let's say for Milton, for instance, or Bunyan, that you're living at a time when the regimes are changing and their fundamental kind of confessional identities and oaths, and the oaths are changing too, right?
Yeah.
It's hard because I sympathize with those in the 1660s. I sympathize with those in the 16 after the Glorious Revolution, when there's a lot of non-jurors and a lot of those who can't conform to the new regime. So I think, yeah, with someone like Dryden, I think, you know, he converts in a way twice, but not a third time. You know, when I teach students about that, I try to communicate to them that this is a time, this would be like living at a time of rapidly changing regimes. And it's hard to remain, it's hard to know what to remain true and loyal to at a time like that. And I think for Dryden, with Catholicism, he finds at least conceptually something, something foundational and traditional and old that he can find that authority in. So, and it really is an age desperate to find a stable source of authority, right? That can generate the kind of social cohesion that everyone is anxiously and obsessively searching for.
But
a lot of conversions for those reasons. And those like Milton and like Bunyan, you know, who refused to convert. Bunyan's in prison for like 12 years or something because he refuses to stop preaching, you know, and they're like, just stop preaching, you know, but he won't because, you know, his conscience tells him he must. So there's something I'm always attracted to those figures, right? Because I think now, when I was thinking of, you know, so, you know, I had, well, we might talk a bit about secularism, but I think there's something in the current, let's say, paradigm of selfhood that we live in. It's so interesting to see those for whom their principles are so significant that they will die for them, or that they will stay in prison for them. It's just hard to, it's such a strange thing, I think, from our current perspective to think of. So I've always found that. When I worked on Defoe, then you find out Defoe is somewhat of a sellout. But the way he presents himself is as, you know, someone who is always committed to truth and he will never back down, you know, no matter how much persecution he undergoes, which some of it he imagined, you know. But
how come he's a sellout? What does he do?
Well, you know, the classic vision of Defoe is that he talks the religious talk, but, you know, when you actually read his work, he's a kind of weathercock who changed loyalties and his religion in Mall. You know, usually a lot of people draw on Mall Flanders and Roxana and then take those values and apply them to Defoe, and Defoe emerges as a kind of secular, irreligious figure who, you know, outwardly had a kind of Sunday, I think Ian Watt calls it like a Sunday religion, but didn't really, you know, at the core level, unlike the old dissenters, you know. And there is, Defoe does have this sense of that he is very attracted to the old dissent of Milton and Bunyan, because that was when for him there was, you know, they stayed true to their values. That's also the reason he dislikes occasional conformity. So mm-hmm. one of the ways around, you know, the Clarendon Code and the Test Acts was you would go once a year to services, mm-hmm. and that would qualify you for office. Yep. And you know, and I understand
Christmas
that.
That's Eve.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, from one perspective, there were a lot of dissenters who felt that that was perfectly justifiable and legal, and there was nothing, you shouldn't have any scruples about that. But Defoe was really attracted, had a kind of nostalgia for that old-timey kind of dissent that was unyielding.
We should say, like, make clear that, you know, there are a lot of narratives of conversions and a lot of people flip-flopping along the sides.
Yeah.
And there are sort of these narratives of people who have remained true to their conscience. Yeah. But for a lot of those people, remaining true to conscience means you just get executed.
Sure, yeah, well, that's true. And of course, yeah, and many of them at the Restoration, many of the Puritans didn't escape execution.
Yep.
Some of them, like Milton, barely did.
Yep.
For some of them, it means being in prison. For some, you know, there's a whole range of being put out of their work. A lot of ministers at the Restoration, about 2,000, you know, were put out of their work. Some of them were in prison. Some of them were fined into bankruptcy. For many of the Puritans, that meant execution, right?
Yep.
Many of those who fought in 1715, 45, also meant execution, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's hard because you don't want to romanticize it.
Yeah.
But there is something appealing. I think considering we live in a very kind of secular, or we can talk about that. The argument goes that we currently live in a secular age. There's something very fascinating and also unsettling about those stories of execution as well. You know, not just for resistance, but for commitment to principles, right?
Yeah. I mean, the price of remaining true to conscience nowadays is much less than the price that you had to pay before.
Yeah. And I think that's true. It's hard to say that. I mean, that's an interesting question, yeah, of whether, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's still a price to it, I think, right?
Yes,
but I think
for sure.
The idea of it is also the very nature, the conditions of belief and staying true to conscience are completely different now
mm-hmm.
as well, right? But yes, and at least in North America, they might be different, right? You wouldn't necessarily be executed. Well, it depends how far your conscience, what kind of ambitions your conscience has, right? Because one of the issue with the Puritans, you know, was that one of their ambitions, one of the dictates of their conscience was to build a godly republic on earth. And I think if that were also your ambition today, you might run into prison or execution.
Well, you'd be allowed to try, right?
Yeah. Don't know if they how much they would let you try that. But yes, they made a good effort in the 1640s and 50s. Yeah. That's why those conversion narratives are also so fascinating, right? Because they seem to be, you know, they also have with them a particular vision of selfhood, like a transformation of inward selfhood that's really
heroic.
Yeah, heroic, yeah. And also kind of a troubling and unsettling too, like in the opera you were talking about. Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I remember most of these ideas around 17th and 18th century toleration and secularization, I've learned from you, sort of just knowing you over the years. And I can remember 3 or 4 years ago now, you're giving an ASEX paper specifically about Milton and disability.
Yeah.
Milton was blind later on in his life.
Yeah.
And that, well, remind me some of those ideas that you presented there, because that seems...
If I can remember them. It's interesting you say how long ago that... So yes, the chapter in this book on toleration is about that. It's about blindness in the 17th century and ideas of disability. But I don't remember exactly what that paper was about. But
it was the early stages.
Yes. And so for Milton, Milton's blindness is both an extremely dated and old topic, but also one that's still interesting because it raises questions about, you know, autonomy and religion and identity. So Milton, by the time he dictates Paradise Lost, is completely blind. And so that is in itself a kind of interesting achievement because the story goes, this is anecdotal, the story goes that he would envision the poem at night, and then in the morning he would ask to be milked. That was the quote.
By his daughters.
But milked of all that poetic and aesthetic content, you know.
Yeah.
And so it figures, but of course blindness figures centrally and kind of like in, you know, classical myths. So Milton can envision himself as a blind bard, and also figures centrally in Judeo-Christian scripture as well, right?
Yeah.
In the New Testament, particularly, like curing of blindness the conversion from blindness to vision is both metaphorical and also in many cases, you know, that's a story of Christ's miracles. It was also one that had a lot of questions about culpability and sin behind it, right? Mm-hmm. Because the argument was among Milton's enemies that he had been, Milton himself explained that he had exhausted his eyes in the service of liberty.
Right.
But, you know, according to his enemies, this was a punishment for, you know, supporting the regicide, right? Yep. But those are also part of larger debates at the time about about disability and culpability and sin, right?
It's related to religion.
And so,
In that sense that if man is created in the image and the likeness of God, what does it mean then for God to create a blind man?
Or make a man blind.
And there are, I should say at the time, we imagine that the 17th century, you know, their attitude towards that would be highly kind of old-fashioned and dated. Like they would say, well, you know, those born with disabilities, that they're somehow possessed or they're corrupt. But at the time, I mean, as you can imagine, in actual writing and congregations, it happens all the time. There's people born with disabilities. There's people with mobility impairments, with developmental disabilities. And a lot of the writing, most of the writing says that it is not a sign of inward corruption or sin. In the story of John 9, also there's a similar moment where the apostles say, you know, who sinned, you know, that this man is blind? And the explanation at the time was that everyone did. We were all sinners. And so it represented that, but it didn't represent some personal sin of the person. But that gets into difficult questions about federal sin versus, you know, personal sin, which are weird questions, right? I was just reading a weird tract on that. But though that gets into weird theology stuff. But it gets into this issue that to engage with the period, it's political writing, it's moral writing, it's imaginary writing. It does take a bit of knowledge of the kind of religious background, you know, as you were saying before, David. It's interesting that whether if you're reading Equiano, if you're reading Defoe, if you're reading Swift, if you're reading Elizabeth Singer Rowe, you know, you some fluency with the religious underpinnings of the period does it's either necessary or it helps a lot.
Yeah, because it's not so. I guess the theme that I wanted to explore today was that the 18th century is commonly known to be one that featured heavy secularization, right? The diminishment of religion, at least its role in public life or governance. Mm-hmm. But what I'm finding out from talking to Andrew and as I read more and more stuff is that a lot of it is religiously girded, whether it's obvious or not. And that this understanding is quite important.
Sure, yeah. And that's true. And that idea that that idea that the 18th century, the Enlightenment more broadly, is a kind of secular period, as an old, it's called the secularization thesis, a kind of old established idea.
The age of reason.
Yeah, the age of reason from the, you know, it's rooted in the 20th century, primarily that idea, and you find it in Marx, and you find it in Durkheim, and you find it in Freud, and you find it in Weber, and R.H. Tawney. And the basic argument goes that with the age of reason and rationalization and the scientific method and increasing knowledge about the universe, religion actually decreased in social importance and personal importance for people. And it's a kind of a classic narrative of the 18th century. I think I must have encountered it originally when I was working on Defoe, of course, because Defoe is often thought of as the emblem or the embodiment of secularization, though there's religion in his writing. In, you know, the common reading of Robinson Crusoe or used to be that there's religion in there, but it's pretty superficial stuff, you know. Yeah. And when you read Moll Flanders, you know, there's a bit of religion in there, but it kind of figures instrumentally and insignificantly. I think Marx says, what does he say? He says, you know, something like, of his prayers we take no account, since they are a source of pleasure to him. And Ian Watt calls his religion kind of Sunday religion that, you know, appears on the page, but is not really meaningful to the foundational plot. So, yeah, there's a sense that it's a secularizing period, right? Though I should say that's now fallen out of favor, that particular view of the 18th century.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so this podcast episode is pretty in line with the current wave of academia?
Yeah, well, it's fallen out of favor, you know, as you can imagine, with the persistence of religious belief and spiritual belief and the resurgence of religious fundamentalism, you know, the idea that the world was becoming more secular and that increased education and rationalism would essentially spell the end of religion, that's obviously lost some of its explanatory power.
And that's
the most basic kind of historiographic critique of it. But it is true that there's, you know, many trends in the 18th century that, despite kind of historiographic nuance and back and forth, you know, that there's kind of secularizing trends in the 18th century. It comes down to how much we see those rooted in science and emerging in science, and how we see their ramifications and effects, right?
A lot of the times we read stuff from people like Defoe or Pope, rather, or Fielding, who are in sort of those upper echelons of society. They're aristocrats, they're wealthy, they have land, they don't really need to sort of mingle with the populace. And they have this freedom, increased freedom at least, to think about higher ideas. Like, ooh, we should secularize society, we should trust in empiricism and nothing else. But that might not be reflective of the larger masses, which at this point are still, you know, relatively uneducated, right? We don't have a public school system yet to regulate and normalize a standard of education. I feel like a lot of those people, the masses of people, are still quite religious, right?
They wouldn't be like...
You still go to church, for instance.
And there are complaints at the time about dropping church attendance. Of course, at the level of popular culture, at the folk level, you know, you see this a lot when you read Defoe's System of Magic or Political History of the Devil, right?
Mm-hmm.
That at the popular level, at the kind of level of everyday life, across the classes, but especially, among lower classes, religion figures, not only religious institutions and rituals figure in everyday life very significantly, but also beliefs in the supernatural, in spirits and demons, in possession, still never really, it's not like they suddenly go out of favor and people embrace a wholly scientific worldview or something. And I mean, the other thing at the time too is that, you know, atheism is still essentially largely unimaginable as a vision of the universe. And so there's complaints about infidelity, about ungodliness, about swearing and immorality and dropping church attendance. That's not the same as a kind of a world without religion. Right?
Yeah.
That was the interesting thing about Fielding's later conversion, was that he spent his life kind of, you know, early on in his career as a playwright, then he becomes a novelist. But really the bulk of his life, or the, you know, the golden years of his life, were spent as a magistrate. And his turn towards religion in the end is this weird kind of attempt to assert, or he wants to try to assert, some kind of social control. And he thinks, or he argues, that religion is the way to find only way we're going to rein in on this loud and noisy rabble in the streets and the prostitutes across the river is to force people to subscribe to these particular moral worldview.
That also came up during our last recording with Mira. She brought up that her argument was that the devil continues to sort of make its appearance and presence felt throughout the 18th century despite these narratives of secularization. And it's largely used as keeping people accountable for their actions, even in their private lives.
Though interestingly, like a lot of the evidence, that can be used either in favor of the importance of religion or as an argument for secularization, because once you approach religion essentially in that instrumental manner, not as the truth about the universe, but once you say, all right, what's religion good for? Socially controlling people. And then emerges in the 18th century. It emerges particularly in the wake of the interregnum in English Civil War.
Yeah.
After that, you see all this desire for practical, you know, a focus on religion, not for its transcendent truths, but for its social ability to manage, to not necessarily in a kind of terrifying Foucauldian way to like manage the populace, but actually to generate morality, inculcate morality and good habits. You see a strong focus after the Restoration on bad and good habits. But once you start to say, well, religion is really important to society, we should keep it around to have people have good habits and live well, that's also kind of might be a secular approach to religion, where it becomes essentially,
interesting,
you know, to generate the kind of society you want. Once you're thinking in terms of those end games of what kind of society do we want, not what is true or not true, but we want this society, what religion would be best for
you? A really pragmatic rather than spiritual approach to religion.
Mm-hmm. I went to Catholic school growing up for 12 years.
I wanted to bring this up, yes.
Yeah, and at the time, when I was in it, I knew no different. And so, to me, the kind of
calm... You guys hadn't gotten the Reformation yet, eh?
We hadn't had the Reformation yet.
I'm a little behind there, but yeah.
So, as I got older and into my teen years and those rebellious years, you, of course, start to have those kind of questions and those...
You flip open the New rebellions. Testament, you're like, oh, no way.
No complaints whatsoever, though, because by the time I did then move on to into university and started studying literature full time, I was absolutely dumbfounded by the sheer amount of influence that just a text like the Bible has on literature, especially within the 18th century.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
kind of this touchstone off of which all other literature then develops.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and also... first of all, reading the Bible itself, because of the Reformation, you know, the focus on individual, personal Bible reading oneself.
Right.
And then also through sermons, through the Book of Common Prayer, and then also sermons commenting on the Bible. And you see this in a lot of writers, the extent to which even their particular kind of understandings of character and identity and particular paradigms of like personality are rooted in biblical context, right? And also visions of vision of the political system is built on biblical precedents, and closest also the vision of the great chain of being, popes, you know, from God down to man, God down to the angels to man.
That's right.
That kind of a religiously oriented vision of one's position in the universe. So that's also why it's hard at the time for them to imagine a vision not only of the universe but of oneself that is not religiously supported or derived from those models.
Could you talk a little bit more about the great chain of being? I think it makes a lovely visual.
Yes, it is. When I taught it this year, and I think I succeeded. I hope I tried to communicate to the students, you know, because how this weirdly conservative and kind of unimaginably old-fashioned vision of the universe could have been so, or at least not necessarily unquestioned at the time, but how it could have been such an appealing understanding of oneself and one's own position and occupation. I think what's appealing about it, Pope has this line too where he talks about how God is even in the hairs on one's head. So the idea that you are not outside of religion and choosing between, you know, Charles Taylor talks about this, how now with these different beliefs and we're kind of outside them and we can say, oh, interesting, I'm Catholic, but look at these beliefs. The fact of living inside those beliefs, that even in your hair, in the hairs on your head and your everyday work of shoveling coal, God is in that. And he has, you know, there's not only is there a providential plan for you, but you are inhabiting that world. There's no outside of that world. You're inhabiting that world, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think they got why it was appealing. I mean, we moved on to less conservative visions of society, to ones that make more sense about social mobility and meritocracy and personal autonomy. And those, I think, are more congruent with our current values.
Right.
But it is interesting to think of what could have been appealing about what to us seem, you know, these kind of insanely old-fashioned models of identity and personhood, you know. And it's not like everyday people repeating these to themselves, but it was more, just the way they understood themselves, the narrative of their life and their position.
Yeah,
right?
I'm just imagining like an 18th century peasant person just repeating, I am a link in the great chain of being.
And you see in Pope's essay on N2, you do see that there's a beautiful side to it. And he also suggests, you know, there's also a kind of element of anxiety. He suggests, well, if you were to press on upper rungs, the lower rungs might press on you.
Yeah.
And so you see that still, that abiding anxiety about the possibility, always ever-present possibility of social collapse.
Yeah.
And this is where you see all the anxieties about the church in danger and the importance of maintaining the established church. This age-defining anxiety about disorder, even though in some ways it's actually a deeply disorderly age, deeply dirty and filthy and filled with disease.
The disorder too, I remember you telling me this one time, is so it's all rooted in these very minor religious quips that different denominations have with each other. These are massive political arguments over whether or not one should be taking the host at mass.
Or whether we should have bishop, or whether they should be called bishops or that, or whether we should be doing the sign of the cross or kneeling and stuff like that.
When you're inside of religion, that becomes a kind of life and death question.
Yeah.
But then as you move outside of it, as Taylor and we're arguing today.
Yeah. They seem like varieties of different things.
Yeah, it seems so trivial and not important. Not worth all of the infighting that it led to in Parliament.
And I think there is that sense. I mean, one of the things that defined, you see this in particularly in Locke, but also in writers like Shaftesbury, is that one of the things that defines so much of the moral and ethical and religious writing of the late 17th, early 18th century is that exhaustion with all this fighting. Like, do we want to, you know, do we want to pursue these debates and see more bloodshed? Or would we not, or would we like to have a system that, however imperfect, generates kind of peace and reduces bloodshed? So a lot of it comes out of that sense of this this exhaustion with the great violence yield of these tiny debates, or to us, I think from the inside, these are fundamentally different worldviews about community and about identity and about justice. And the ramifications of them are often really about who can be included in your community and not. So if you say, well, actually, you know, I'm reading about baptismal debates now. If you say to be baptized, you know, we don't want infants baptized, to be baptized, you have to make an adult profession of faith, that transforms who's within your community and who is not within your community. It transforms who is punished and who is spared. And so they are, it's interesting because at one level they look, you know, absurdly minor, but at the other level they could be the very thresholds of community and justice, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I can understand the desire for this kind of setting down of regular standard for this, because it's these little quibbles that form like the bedrock of the foundation of your faith, right? Because, you know, if you start letting this little thing go and letting that little thing go, soon enough, you know, you'll have nothing left.
Yeah.
And that's, go ahead, Kyle.
No, I was just going to add to the foundations of your faith and your sort of political ruling, too.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and that's true. And I mean, those debates also seem also comically overblown to us, debates about politics and debates about succession, you know, and they seem, you know, irrelevant and alien to our age. But yeah, they are, there's a lot at stake there. And I think, of course, what you see in the period with the development of latitudinarianism and deism and less strictly orthodox approach to religions is you do see the kind of I don't want to call it watering down because that's bad, but you do see the loosening of a lot of these restrictions as the importance of orthodoxy it decreases and the the value of inclusion and social harmony increases. So you do see a lot of that, you know, with the, you know, not among everyone, but among the low church and among among more centrist kind of nonconformists like Presbyterians, you know, a loosening up of those values for the sake of, you know, social cohesion, I guess.
The more politically minded, socially minded management system in the beginning. And then later on, we get past the trauma of the Civil War. We can let people do what
they want. Sure, yeah. That's, I mean, well, that's hard to say because the one of the ways, one of the ways to trace this through is attitudes towards zeal or enthusiasm, as it's called, attitudes towards religions based on kind of internal revelation and emotions from God, right? Which, of course, early on are associated with Puritanism, and the danger of that is the feelings that you get from God are to overthrow the government. And so, under, you know, with Methodism and with other kind of heart religions, you see a resurgence of interest in those heart-based and feeling-based religious experiences. But I do think, I think that suggests, one, that some of the anxieties either have receded or they have been regulated in, successfully regulated in new ways. Because Methodism, of course, also could represent a kind of dangerous radicalism as well. Like among Puritans, a kind of middling to lower class based heart religion based on what your conscience says you should do. You know, so I think they do represent the fact that either those anxieties have receded maybe, or that, you know, they've been successfully regulated in other ways. Though to be fair, I mean, dissent, nonconformity also continues to play a kind of, particularly later in the 18th century, a reformist, I can't say radical, but has a reformist edge to it, you know? And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the period is that many of the values that we associate with kind of modern secularism, like free speech and religious liberty and you know, those are actually rooted in, you know, religious discourse. You know, yeah. We can trace those back. You know,
to Milton is
And Milton, of course, one of the great proponents of great Christian Puritan proponents of free speech. Yes. You know. And of course, the other high stakes debate that is rooted in this is all the debates about divine right and resistance to the government, which is still, of course, an issue today about people who, you know, well, this came up a while ago with that woman who refused to give the marriage licenses.
Oh, yeah.
But these moments where where one's conscience, let's call it
religious conscience,
let's say robustly developed conscience, where those come into conflict with establishment. That's the, that kind of is the classic, you know, a conflict of the 17th century, right? The magistrates, the magistrates' compulsion against the Christian's conscience. And then Milton responds to that, and Hobbes and Locke responds to that, all in different ways. But for over the longer term, it's of course Locke's paradigm of kind of inward belief that cannot be compelled and shouldn't be compelled, that has is given a, that we've inherited essentially, you know, under with the American independence and with you know, the French Revolution, the idea that one's religious belief should not be compelled or affected by the magistrate, as they would call it, or the government. You know, that's rooted in that those particular debates in the 17th century, right?
Right.
And I think what's interesting in the current debates about secularism and post-secularism is that now we're beginning to see how much a lot of the kind of our naturalized relationships to religious difference and toleration and liberalism were actually emerged from a very historically specific moment where some of the highest priorities were regulating violence and generating social uniformity. And so our values emerge from those moments for better or worse, I guess.
Yeah. You were talking earlier before the recording about like the current pros and cons of secularism, actually. Yes. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yes, yes. We don't have to get completely into that. Pulls us both away, or pulls us not away from the 18th century, but to a different relationship to the 18th century than a purely historical one. But of course, a renewed, you know, interest in the 18th century and Enlightenment these days is very much energized and shaped by the fact that we have inherited so many of our values. You know, we've inherited liberal values from the 18th century and from the Enlightenment, and we still in some ways, there's debate on this, but we still live in the Enlightenment in a way.
Yep.
And so, yes, so there's been a lot of interest in secularism, critiques of it, examinations, you know,
critiques of secularism.
Yeah,
that was my
are you okay, Cal? Are you okay over there? Are you okay?
My blood's boiling.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Critiques of secularism, both historiographic critiques, ethical critiques, kind of Foucauldian deconstructive critiques. And those take various forms. Probably the most, you know, Charles Taylor is probably one of the best known ones. The other one might be Talal Asad. Those are there's a whole range of post-secular theory out there. And it takes various tacks in relation to it. Some of it merely deconstructs the history of secularism and points out to us that it's kind of a historically constructed thing, not necessarily inevitable. And that's also quite obvious to us now. But some of it also critiques secularism, raises ethical and moral critiques against secularism as a form of governmentality and power that is perhaps not necessarily 100% bad, but that is perhaps less uniformly fair and wholesome than we had once thought. Yeah, and there's various, I don't know, do we want to go into this or not? You wanted to go into this.
Maybe not. But to sort of assuage your fears about these criticisms, most of them cannot offer a better alternative, or they do not offer
well,
a better
alternative. Well, you skipped, I said that in passing. I can't say that isn't true. This is something I was talking about with another person. It's certainly difficult. This would be like saying critiques of capitalism, they can't offer an alternative to capitalism.
Okay, which, well, there's a clear alternative to capitalism.
No, sorry, I mean,
but people say that,
yeah, exactly. But one people say, well, you know, a legit, you know, there will be no kind of taking down of capitalism at this point. We're at the end of it, you know. But yes, but what, so there's been a lot of critiques of secularism, and some of them I think quite sound. As I was saying to you, there's been, you know, people pointing out that secularism makes very different levels of demands from people and exerts a lot of different amounts of pressure on people. So on one person, it might demand nothing. On another, it might demand an extremely painful sacrifice that breaks their relationship to their own identity and their own family history. And so it's not, in that sense, a uniformly fair system. Now, there's responses to that. But a lot of them have shown that, particularly surrounding a number of controversies, like the Danish cartoon controversy that got a lot of people...
And the French one, yeah.
Yeah, and the French, yeah. And those obviously raised questions about either the shortcomings of our established models and potentially the kind of injustices of our established models. But as I did say, one of the challenges has been that, has been envisioning workable and ethically robust alternatives to this. That because, you know, as I was saying, we trace these back to the 17th century, 17th and 18th century, significantly to Locke, though we also might look at, we also might look at Hobbes and Mill, but the aim of the existing model of dealing with religious difference is not necessarily, you know, individual fullness and fulfillment, but it's to manage religious difference so that we can live in a society where you have very different understandings of religion and good and identity than I do, but nonetheless the framing of the society is such that we don't kill each other. And that is kind of the end purpose of those paradigms, right? And it's hard to deny that that in itself is a it's a good thing, but it might mean...
So it goes back to those like ideas of toleration.
Yeah, it goes back to these, And toleration, there's been a lot of also work on probably one of the best books on this is Wendy Brown's Regulating Aversion, which critiques toleration as a kind of form of governmentality that is part of the imperial project. It does show that that might work. That might actually work as a good model for society, but it doesn't necessarily mean it isn't a form of power and privilege, right?
Right.
So it might be. Those are some of the critiques of it. But as I was saying, it's hard to envision an alternative because these emerged from a time of religious violence, and the purpose of these paradigms was to, I won't say get rid of violence, but Talal Asad says to regulate violence, to give the government control over violence. So that we don't exert it against each other. And if you break the laws, then you will be thrown in prison and potentially executed. But that we don't exert violence against each other, right? And so it's hard to deny that that's a good end result of that system. But some of the critiques of it have been that it is self-serving. And I was saying to David that, of course, it's notable that, those who support it unequivocally and without problem, it generally benefits, it's not that difficult for them. So it's easy for me or you or, someone else to say, I think everyone should just, mediate their religious beliefs through the established system as long as they don't break the laws or cause any trouble, they can believe what they want. That might be extremely easy for me to do, and it might be, it might present painful challenges or even self-effacing, self-destructive choices for other people. And so it's notable that I guess the thing
reproduces
is it
produces similar sins originally.
Yeah, yeah, and it's built on those. But the problem is we know that it's we don't know anymore, I guess. It was originally thought that it was a good system because it manages these religious conflicts, right? We don't kill each other. It asks the people...
At least not domestically.
Yeah, domestically. It asks the people, Locke has a decision where you privatize your beliefs. And so they make a difference. They might happen in your domestic life or personally, but you don't have any ambitions to, establish religious law, or you don't have any ambitions to, overthrow. And you just have your private beliefs. I have mine. Mine may say you're wrong, but I don't kill you. That's the kind of ideal of that system. But I do think some of the critiques of it have shown that that is not necessarily in itself, that's not in itself the exclusive kind of ethical possibility. There are other ones. Yeah, but the challenge has been envisioning alternatives that are workable and also ethically robust, right?
Yeah.
Kantian. Cosmopolitan kind of toward perpetual peace kind of thing.
Sure, yeah, and there's other alternatives. Milton also has his own visions of error and disbelief, and there's the Ottoman millet system is often invoked as an alternative to this, where there are different religious communities that live under a single regime but live in harmony but are separate. So there are other ways of imagining it.
They don't interact. They're just.
Let me just look. Look at this.
Do they live by separate laws?
Let's see. And you all pay. So it's independent. The millet system. So this is often invoked as an alternative, where you pay taxes Ottoman Turkish religious, religious community. Let's see here.
What if my religion says I can't pay religion
to define each male... Pardon?
If my religion says I can't pay taxes.
Well, but that's actually the interesting question, yeah. Right? About what do you do when there's particular beliefs that conflict with the defining characters. So maybe we don't say actually we have to get along. We actually live separately in different communities, and that's fine. But then my religion says I have to interact with other communities.
Yeah,
I have to evangelize, right? Yeah, I have to convert. Yeah. Then you run into these kind of problems. But I do think the nice thing about the good thing about a lot of this recent scholarship is we've been thinking a bit more. You know, there's been a critique of the idea that this is the only way to manage religion, and there's also been recognition that that it is experienced differently and that it has different impacts on different people. Whereas I think traditionally there was a sense that there's the best way for society to go, this will be the best for all societies, and as societies progress, this was the secularism thesis, that all societies will move towards this. I think historiographically we know that's not true anymore, and then ethically there's also been questions about whether that is whether that's the best way. Yeah. Oh, let's wind it down. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks for saying that.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh, now you have to edit that, right?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, but we won't get into all the discussions of that. But it is interesting. I think people have been interested in it because there is an abiding sense that there's an interest. You know, you see this in more nuanced, in also more nuanced forms, in like, you know, Habermas and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's an interest in the fact that the existing model we have didn't seem to work out mm-hmm. as we had hoped it would. So first of all, what was wrong with it, and what alternatives or adjustments depending on your position in relation to it are possible.
Nice. I really like this aspect of the 18th century is that a lot of the ideas that we live by now find their origins here, and we are mm-hmm. able to go back and mine the past literature and culture for sort of tidbits on how to perhaps move forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think there's been interest in that as well. Not necessarily, searching for wisdom in the old ways, but still looking to recuperate perhaps neglected ideas or thinking of these ideas in new ways, because so many of our values are rooted in the 18th century and the Enlightenment, right? Particularly things like free speech and empiricism and rationality. I think that's what makes it, not to say everyone's interested in reading, you know, Hume and Shaftesbury and and Descartes and everything, but it does generate the kind of at least widespread interest in these questions about free speech and about religious difference and about secularism and that kind of thing. So I think that's at least a source of ongoing interest. I don't think, though there's been lots of talk of Enlightenment values, I don't know if we're yet prepared to discard them, but there has been a lot of interest in their origins and potential virtues and limitations, I think.
Cool. I think that's a pretty nice point to end on. We're going to have you back, Andrew. At some point, maybe.
Too much to talk about.
I know.
Mm-hmm. We didn't even talk much about, Dryden or Swift or anything like that. But,
Cool. Well, it's been very nice having you here with us in the recording studio.
Thanks for listening.